It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. Later this hour, Justin Chang is in Cannes for the Historic Film Festival. We'll talk with him about this year's edition and some of the highlights. High-profile directors like Spike Lee, Lars von Trier, and others. We'll hear what Justin thought about the movies that he saw. But first, the movies in release locally throughout Southern California. And with us to talk about them, film critic for the Christian Science Monitor, Peter Rayner, and film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of YouTube's What the Flick, Christy Lemire. We begin with the sequel Deadpool 2. Ryan Reynolds returns in the starring role. David Leitch is the director, and the screenwriters Rhett Reese, Paul Wernick, and Ryan Reynolds. Christy, what'd you think of Deadpool 2?
Well, if you like Deadpool, this is another Deadpool. This is pretty much the exact same movie, and they had a winning formula on their hands the first time around. I mean, it was a hardcore, hard R comic book movie, and it went to places that the PG-13 spectacles didn't and couldn't and chose not to. This is every bit as profane, every bit as raunchy, every bit as wrong, but it's a lot of fun, and the style of humor is very much in Ryan Reynolds' wheelhouse. So as you see, because he is, as you mentioned, one of the writers of it. So once again, Deadpool is back. It begins with him dying, and the whole rest of the thing is a flashback. This is not a spoiler. It is literally the first thing you see in the movie.
Because he can't die.
He can't die, right. Things he has
and neither
cancer.
Can this franchise.
Right, and nor will it, because it makes a lot of money. So it's about how he has to go back in time several weeks earlier and team up with some of the lesser-known X-Men to defeat Cable, who is a bad guy played by Josh Brolin. He is also
Thanos. Not the
Thanos.
Same bad guy in Avengers, by
He's
the way.
He's Thanos and Cable. What can't he do? So here is yet another muscular, intimidating bad guy who has come through time from the future, Terminator style, to right some wrongs and wreak havoc in the process. But basically, that plot is just an excuse for massive action scenes, massive fight scenes. The director, David Leitch, also did Atomic Blonde last summer. He's a former stunt coordinator. He directed one of the John Wick movies. So the fight scenes really matter. The choreography to them really matters, and they're not overly edited. It's a lot of fun. I mean, it's not novel like the first one was, and there's actually a surprising emotional underpinning to it, I will say that. So I had a good time.
What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, you use the word plot in quotes. I think. You know, given the fact that Leitch was a stunt coordinator, I found that what I liked least about it were the action scenes. I thought they were sort of chaotic and you know, woozy. And I liked much more just the crazy outlaw comedy of it, which is what I liked in the first film, too. The first film was sort of an eye-opener because the Marvel movies had been pretty serious up until that point. And this film is just a total goof. So this, you know, takes off on that. So the novelty isn't quite there for this film that was there for the first one. But there are a lot of funny, you know, sort of meta jokes like, you know, the jabs at DC Comics, the DC Comic Empire, and the Wolverine jokes. And there's a great takeoff on the opening of the James Bond, you know, credit sequences that comes in the film. That's a really terrific riff. Ryan Reynolds is very funny. Some of the new additions, like Zazie Beetz,
she's great.
Domino is very good. But I do find, you know, after a while, the nonstop jokiness of it is kind of wearing. You know, in its own way, being like too funny all the time can be just as wearying as being serious all the time.
Yeah, it will beat certain jokes to death. There's a couple yeah. different jokes like, okay, we've seen this joke. Let's move on now. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they always repeat stuff.
That was kind of my sense of the first film, which had, you know, so many flat-out hilarious parts. I thought it was way too long, the first one. And that, you know, with the jokes are hit and miss. I mean, sometimes they're very funny.
Right.
Other times they're just, you know, kind of groaners. And I was just wondering, is this one 2 hours like the first one?
Yep. It's a minute shy of 2 hours.
Yeah, it feels longer.
Yeah, I thought the first one felt long. It's like,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's because of that nonstop jokiness. You know, it's sometimes if you make a movie that's really scattershot fast, it can seem longer than a movie that isn't that way. It's a paradox, but it's true.
Yeah, because there's really no plot. It's all about the
it's a joke book.
Yeah. Deadpool 2, the action comedy starring Ryan Reynolds, Marina Baccarin, Josh Brolin star, David Leitch the director. It's rated R in wide release. Book Club, a comedy starring Diane Keaton, Jane Fonda, Candice Bergen, and Mary Steenburgen. Bill Holderman makes his directorial debut, and he co-wrote the screenplay with Aaron Sims. Peter?
Well, by all rights, shouldn't a movie starring Diane Keaton, Jane Fonda, Mary Steenburgen, and Candice Bergen be worth seeing? In theory, yes, but I think this movie sort of tests that theory. You know, it's kind of a dingbatty goof movie that certainly appeals to a particular demographic. But I don't think that the jokes are very funny. These four women are best friends, and they have this book club. And so the book they've chosen to talk about is 50 Shades of Grey. And the one funny joke about that is that one of the women says, "Is this even a book?" You know. So this book sort of sets them off on various randy escapades. Mary Steenburgen has a marriage that's sort of gone cold sexually. Jane Fonda is a Beverly Hills hotelier who screws around with men without attachment. Candice Bergen is a judge who's been divorced for many years. You know, and Diane Keaton, you know, has her own issues where she has these two daughters. She's been widowed and they want her to move to Arizona and live in their basement, and they're overprotective. I don't know, Chrissy. I found that you probably will like this movie more than I did, I'm guessing.
Because I'm a woman?
Well, because you're smiling.
I'm smiling because I'm enjoying all the things that you're saying that are wrong with it, and I'm agreeing with you, actually. This is why I'm smiling.
Okay.
This is essentially geriatric Sex and the City. Right? Because each character lines up with one of those women. Jane Fonda is the leopard print wearing, oversexed, double entendre spewing Samantha figure. And Mary Steenburgen is the prim mom who does charity work. So she's Charlotte. And Candice Bergen is who Miranda would become. She's a federal judge and she's the voice of reason. And then Diane Keaton is our narrator. So she's Carrie, and she's the one who actually dates. Yeah, when the four of them are together in the room, and they're drinking Chardonnay, bottle after bottle, and they're just goofing on each other, and they have this wonderful friendship with each other that you can really feel, those parts work.
So there's good chemistry
there
with
is.
The quartet.
There is, and they're such pros that even though the jokes are pretty lame, like, they have such perfect timing after all these years of doing this that they make it all sing. It's when they all go off into their individual storylines, right? And so they each date people. Candice Bergen tries to figure out internet dating, and so you have lame jokes about her not understanding her computer. She's a federal judge. Come on, she's brilliant. And then Diane
Keaton. Lots of Viagra jokes.
Yes, poor Craig T. Nelson.
Selfie jokes.
Yes, it's lame. And then, but then Diane Keaton has some nice chemistry with Andy Garcia as the pilot. Literally, his name is The Pilot.
Yeah,
they don't even give him a name.
That is like Sex in the City.
He's Mr. Big, pretty much.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. No, so two of the women, Jane Fonda hooks up with this guy, an old flame she hasn't seen in 40 years, played by Don Johnson. And, you know, and Andy Garcia magically appears on a plane with Diane Keaton. It's like, you know, this deus machina of these two dreamboats.
Yep.
Who, you know, who rescue these women from their lives of, you know, Randy. It all seemed, you know, very condescending in a way. Also, was this some sort of weird, creepy in-joke that Don Johnson is in this movie, given
right.
that his daughter is the star
of
the 50
Shades.
Shades.
That's right, Dakota, yeah.
That did not occur to me until afterward, but yeah, that was kind of icky in retrospect.
Odd, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, this is essentially like a wacky, sitcom-y version of a Nancy Meyers movie. They all have amazing kitchens and throw pillows. So if that's what you want that escape, have fun.
You referred to them as geriatric, which I understand technically is probably correct, but it's hard for me to think of these four women as geriatric.
Well, but that's the other thing. I mean, they have a lot of dynamism, these actresses, and to sort of play this, you know, kind of randy geriatric shtick, they deserve better.
All right. The movie is Book Club, the comedy starring Diane Keaton, Jane Fonda, Candace Bergen, and Mary Steenburgen. Bill Holderman directs and co-wrote, rated PG-13 in wide release. The thriller First Reformed is written and directed by Paul Schrader, who has done so many films in the past, the screenwriter of Taxi Driver. The film First Reformed stars Amanda Seyfried and Ethan Hawke. Christy, what'd you think?
This is the best movie of the week, or at least the best new release of the week, because we'll talk about 2001, A Space Odyssey later on. This is Paul Schrader back in peak form. And if you are a fan of his, and if you are a fan of the best of what he can do, this is very much in the vein of Taxi Driver. And the character that Ethan Hawke plays has a lot of Travis Bickle in him. And in the best ways, in the most interesting, in the most disturbing, in the most provocative ways, he plays a priest at this historic church in upstate New York, little bitty old historic church, which has long since become just like a tourist destination. Not a lot of parishioners come. It's been dwarfed by this mega church nearby in town where Cedric the Entertainer is the pastor, and he's great.
That's great casting.
It's a really...
Yeah,
he's
it's
like
a serious performance.
He's like a T.D. Jakes figure, kind of. It's a really rare dramatic role for him. He's really great in this. And Amanda Seyfried comes to Ethan Hawke's character, who is quiet and clearly struggling with some demons, and she wants him to help her husband, who is also struggling with some demons. And Ethan Hawke becomes more and more deeply entrenched in their family, in their lives. And there's a fascinating narrative construct that Schrader uses, which has some echoes of Taxi Driver, in that Ethan Hawke's character promises at the beginning of the film to journal everything he's going through and to be brutally honest with himself and to write down everything, whether it hurts or not, in this very perfect handwriting. And as the film progresses, there becomes this deviation between what he's writing and the reality of what we see, and his self-destruction and his obsessiveness become just gripping and intense and frightening. And it's great. I love the ending. The ending is really vague, like boldly vague. And I dug that about it.
What do you think, Peter?
A little bit less. you know, I think, you know, Schrader is a very powerful screenwriter in films like Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and so forth. He's described forever, you know, that he grew up in a Calvinist Christian Reformed church. He didn't see a movie till he was 17. And a lot of his more, you know, out there movies are about the agonies of faith and redemption. They're usually culminating in a violent act, you know, that is meant to be spiritually cleansing. And I think that that's what this film follows, but in a schematic way. Some of it is powerful and haunting. I think Ethan Hawke is strong. The fact that this priest sort of, you know, verges into eco-terrorism thinking that climate change is sort of the end of days, and that's really a mirror of what's going on inside of him that's dark. You know, all of that is potentially powerful, but I found that it's very schematic in the way that it's set up. And very closely patterns Schrader's idol, Robert Bresson, about whom he partially wrote a book years ago when he was a critic and a really fine one. And Diary of a Country Priest, especially, is very close to this film in many ways. He's not ripping it off. It's clear that it's an analogy to that movie, but I think too much so. And in that sense, I think the film is somewhat lifeless in the way that it. The camera never moves. It's always sort of, you know, rock solid, showing people, you know, stewing in their own juices. Very Bressonian and dark, but somehow it didn't add up for me as an emotional experience.
It is very bleak, and it is very austere, and it is a slow burn. But I think that the turmoil within him and the change that you slowly see is what helped break it out of that construct that maybe I've think bothered you about it.
Yeah, I find even his films that, you know, critics aren't particularly fond of, was a Hardcore with George C. Scott,
right.
That the world he creates, the atmosphere he creates, even when he doesn't fully execute, I still find very interesting. And wasn't Cat People, that also?
Yes, American Gigolo. And his very first film as a director, Blue Collar, I thought was pretty terrific. And showed off some actors like Richard Pryor that one didn't think of normally as you know, terrific dramatic actors. He's highly talented. I just think that this film is a little, maybe too much in his wheelhouse.
We're talking about First Reformed. For Christy, it's the film of the week. In her view, Peter, not so high on it. Amanda Seyfried, Ethan Hawke, star Paul Schrader, the writer and director. It's rated R. You can see it at the Landmark in West L.A. and the Arclight in Hollywood. Coming up, we'll hear about the British romantic drama On Chesil Beach and the documentary Film Worker about someone very important to Stanley Kubrick's filmmaking. But I do hope you'll join us Saturday night, June 2nd, theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A. We'll show The Graduate, its 50th anniversary, on the big screen. Peter Rayner will join us in a post-film conversation afterward. Tickets, kpecc.org/in-person. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Just in case you didn't know, you have two chances to hear it on the radio, Saturdays at noon and Fridays at 11 o'clock. But you can also listen to it whenever it's convenient by using the KPCC app or by downloading it wherever you get your podcasts. It's Film Week on 89.3. Our critics this week, Christy Lemire and Peter Rayner, and they'll tell us next about On Chesil Beach, a romantic drama from Britain. Saoirse Ronan stars with Emily Watson. Dominic Cook is the director, and Ian McEwan adapted his novel. Peter?
This is a strong and, I think, ultimately deeply moving film. It's based on a 2007 novel by Ian McEwan, a really terrific novel, which he adapted himself for the screen, the screenwriter. And it's about this sort of a couple that he's from a sort of lower middle class family. He's a London University student in history, and played by Billy Howell, and Saoirse Ronan plays a budding classical violinist who comes from an upper class family. They meet, they fall in love. The film flashes back from their wedding night in a Georgian hotel on Chesil Beach in Dorset. And it flashes back to their courtship, and it sort of keeps flashing back and forward. It's, for the most part, until the final sequence where they have their connubial issues, I thought it was a fairly starched and straightforward and respectable movie with terrific acting and a real sense of the period, which was 1962, a time just before the swinging London era, when sex was still very, proper, and both of these young people are virgins, which certainly plays into the movie. But the final sequence, I thought, where they sort of have it out, is absolutely extraordinary and so riveting and powerful that it sort of dispenses with any problems I had with the movie prior to that point.
Yeah, and the fact that they are finally allowing themselves to express their true emotions and who they truly are almost completely. You know, there's still some secrets back there, but that they will let that emotion come out after the awkwardness and the stiltedness of their dinner and their attempts at consummating their marriage. Yeah, it's a really rich sense of place. And you can feel the crunch of their shoes on the rocks on the beach, and you can feel the wind in their hair as they're arguing with each other. But the flashback structure kind of hops around in time, so it's a bit of a mystery as to why they are the way they are, and the pieces kind of fall into place eventually. The absolute ending, there is an absolute ending, doesn't really work.
No.
There is some prosthetic makeup stuff, that's all I'm going to say, and it's a little distracting, but these two have tremendous chemistry. They also co-starred last week in The Seagull. They were also young and in love in The Seagull, but much more passionately and intensely so there. Here they're both a little restrained. But yeah, they have really nice chemistry with each other. And once again, Saoirse Ronan in an Ian McEwan adaptation, the movie that made her a star was Atonement. And once
2007,
again,
2007, the same year this book was published.
Yeah, yeah. She can just do everything. You know?
She's incredibly versatile.
Yeah.
On Chesil Beach is Saoirse Ronan's latest film. Emily Watson in the cast. Dominic Cook directs. It's rated R at the Landmark in West L.A. The documentary Film Worker tells the story of Leon Vitali, right-hand man to director Stanley Kubrick. Peter?
Yeah, this is about a very strange guy. Leon Vitali was an actor for Kubrick and Barry Lyndon. He's the guy that shoots Barry Lyndon. at the end. He was an up-and-coming actor, but he was very he was fascinated with Kubrick as a filmmaker during the making of that film and wanted to sort of become involved in Kubrick's universe and work with him. And so he essentially threw over his career as an actor to become Kubrick's, I don't know, obsessive assistant for, for the rest of his of Kubrick's life. You know, as casting and coaching, marketing, just everything. And it's a fascinating portrait of someone who is so taken over by somebody who he regards as a genius that, that he sort of puts whatever life he had on hold and merges with this genius in such a way that, that you can kind of identify with how he feels. Ryan O'Neill at one point is interviewed in the movie and he says, you know, he says, well, he threw over a good acting career, but, you know, how many times in this business do you get to work with a genius? And so you have to go with that. I guess that's sort of the theme of the movie. Matthew Modine says that, you know, he so it was a kind of selflessness that he gave over to Kubrick, Leon Vitali, that he kind of self-crucified himself.
At the expense of everything else in his life.
He had a wife and kids, which you hardly hear about in this film.
Right. The grown children now appear in the film, but there's great resentment about the fact that their father was perpetually absent. I mean, he would work 18-hour days, and yeah, he was working with a genius, and he got to absorb all of that, but at what cost? I mean, it's a fascinating portrait. If you love film, if you love the process of filmmaking, if you are a fan of Kubrick, there are a lot of really interesting anecdotes. But if you do know about Kubrick, this doesn't really tell you anything new beyond the fact that he was obsessive and he was hard to work for. And
is Vitali inherently interesting?
Yes, he is. He's a fascinating and odd dude.
Yeah, he's
got
still
an odd
I mean,
presence.
He's still an actor. He's just not.
Oh, really?
Acting.
Okay.
In his daily life, he has a lot of presence.
Yeah. No, he is. Yeah. And then when there was that big Kubrick exhibit a couple of years ago at the LACMA, I want to say, and he is nowhere in it. He was not invited to the gala. Like, he, given his important role in Kubrick's life, he was completely snubbed. Having said that, he went back like 25, 30 times with school groups and tour groups and as favors to friends and walked them through, you know, the typewriters and the scripts and the notes in the scripts and all the details. Like, he helped cast these films. He found Danny Lloyd. He found the twins and The Shining. So, you know, he still has a great love, even though he lost his whole life to this person.
We're talking about the documentary Film Worker that profiles Leon Vitali, Stanley Kubrick's right-hand man for years. Tony Zierra is the director. It's unrated at the New Art in West L.A. Speaking of Kubrick, a 70mm remaster of 2001 A Space Odyssey, the remastering overseen by Christopher Nolan, and it made its premiere last weekend at the Cannes Film Festival. It's going to be at the Arclight Hollywood. Peter, your thoughts on, I mean, this is such a visually stunning film to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty incredible. I saw it when it first came out, and I see it every 5 or 6 years. You know, it sort of set the template for almost every film like it that came after. You know, seeing it, if you can get in, you know, this way is going to be a great experience. I just want to make a very quick detour. I always mention the Ojai Music Festival every year, which is going on from June 7th through 10th. And one of the things that will be featured is the composer Ligeti, who's going to be music is featured in on Saturday. And Ligeti's music features prominently in 2001. You know, Lux Aeterna and Atmospheres and, you know, the ooh.
Yeah, all that really intense stuff.
Right, all Ligeti. And so that'll be really great to listen to. And it's all.
Are you going to go see the remastering at the Arclight?
If I can get in, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
because they should let you
They're showing
in
it like 24 hours a day, though. And they're showing it in the Dome at 11 a.m. on Sunday.
Which is where it made its L.A. debut, in the Dome.
It'd be so cool to see it there. There's like 3 seats left. So go get them now.
All right. 2001, A Space Odyssey. Christopher Nolan overseeing the 70mm remastered film, which is going to be screened Arclight Hollywood in the Cinerama Dome there, premiered last Sunday at Cannes. Speaking of Cannes, coming up a little bit later, Justin Chang will report to us from there what he liked at the festival. The documentary Pope Francis, A Man of His Word, from director Wim Wenders. Peter, does this do the pontiff justice?
Well, and then some. Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty... they don't really get into much of the controversy that that Pope Francis has engendered with his you know, various edicts and dictums and sayings. He's Wenders is known for making documentaries as well as dramatic features. In that, he's like Werner Herzog and, you know, Varda and many other directors, Demme, Scorsese. So this is nothing new for him to do this. What I found sort of interesting about the movie is that it's almost entirely non-judgmental. He had tremendous access to Pope Francis. He, I think, spent something like 3 weeks of pretty one-on-one access with him. And so you hear a lot of stuff directly from Pope Francis about all sorts of issues. You also see clips of him at the Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Remembrance Center in Israel. He visits Central African babies in the hospital. He goes to the typhoon in the Philippines, and all of this, you know, he's very, very involved in global hunger and climate change and poverty. This is all very much a part of this movie. And I enjoyed the movie, but I thought there's not enough both background on Wenders' own religious background. I think would have been interesting to know why he made this particular movie in this way. Were there certain questions that were off limits to the Pope? It's almost like a really, really good infomercial for the Pope.
So what if Werner Herzog had done the...
well, let's not go there.
Pope Francis, a man of his word, the documentary from Wim Wenders. It's rated PG in select theaters. The Australian thriller Cargo stars Martin Freeman and Susie Porter. It's directed by Ben Howling and Yolanda Ramke, both of whom are making their directorial debuts. Ramke is the screenwriter. Christy?
So this is a feature-length film version of a short that these two filmmakers did together a few years back, and it is a zombie apocalypse movie.
And we haven't seen those in a while.
I was going to say, we've seen...
But Australia.
We've seen... Yeah, this is different. Totally different continent. we've seen a lot of zombie apocalypse in our lives in the last several years. And so I kind of went into this like, oh, God, not another zombie movie. But this tells the story in a really quiet and intimate and kind of harrowing way with real stakes and really difficult decisions that have to be made here. So Martin Freeman and his wife are living on a houseboat with their infant daughter. And clearly the wife is infected, and Martin Freeman has to figure out what to do from there. This is not a spoiler to say that he also gets infected, because everyone just does. There's just no way to avoid it. Everyone's going to get infected at some point. And so the question becomes, how long will he survive, and how will he figure out how to take care of his baby? How do we keep her from getting infected, and how do we find a safe home for her? And it is in the wilds of Australia. This is not like downtown Sydney. This is like middle of nowhere. And it is a quiet, kind of slow burn. There's a rich sense of place as far as the ground and the vibe of the quiet tension. Martin Freeman's got a really interesting face. And he can do a lot of different kinds of films, whether he's Bilbo Baggins in the Hobbit movies, or he's in The End of the World, or he was in Black Panther recently. He can do a lot of different kinds of genres. And this is just a quiet drama. And you really come to care about him and whether he can make it and whether his little girl can make it. And there definitely is an underlying theme here as far as what has happened to the Aboriginal people, because he comes to rely on them. And it's clear. I think the zombie storyline is clearly an allegory for what has happened to them. So it's good. It's solid. But, you know, if you're sick of zombies, this might not be your cup of tea.
Cargo, Australian thriller, Martin Freeman, Susie Porter star, directed by Ben Howling and Yolanda Ramke. She wrote the screenplay. It's unrated, and it's streaming on Netflix, Cargo, the film. Coming up, we'll hear about the Chinese drama Angels Wear White and the documentary Always at the Carlisle about that New York hotel. But again, want to remind you to join us for our next Film Week screening series coming up very soon. It's Saturday night, June 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel, The Graduate on the big screen for the 50th anniversary. And the producer of The Graduate, Lawrence Terman, is going to be with us to talk about it afterwards. Our Peter Rayner will be on stage afterwards as well. You can get your tickets at kpecc.org/in-person. We'd love to see you there on the 2nd. Coming up in just a few minutes, Justin Chang, our Film Week critic, Los Angeles Times film critic, comes our way from the Cannes Film Festival, and we'll hear what he thinks about the debut of the new Spike Lee film. Lars von Trier, also after a seven-year absence after his remarks about Hitler got him banned, he's back. We'll find out about his new movie. But we continue with this week's reviews with Peter Rayner and Christy Lemire. Angels Wear White, a Chinese drama that stars Vicky Chen. It's written and directed by Vivian Q. Peter?
This is a very good movie. It's set in a small seaside town. There's a motel there. And one night, this middle-aged guy brings in these two, you know, giggly 12-year-old girls into his room, and you know what happens. And the girl who is substitute receptionist that night is the only eyewitness to it. But because she's undocumented and for other reasons, she doesn't fess up to anything. A lawyer at one point, a female lawyer, tries to, you know, cozy up to her and get the information. It turns out that the man involved in the motel is part of a much larger web of corruption involving law enforcement and so forth. It's all a very, you know, dark movie about a very, you know, male-dominated world where these women are sort of fighting to get out. And it's very well acted, very powerful in many ways. I thought it was a terrific film.
Vivian Q is the writer-director of Angels Wear White. The Chinese drama is at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. It's unrated. Always at the Carlisle, a documentary about the famous New York Hotel. It's written and directed by Matthew Mila. Christy?
This is essentially an infomercial for the Carlisle Hotel. It is entertaining here and there. It is an hour and a half long, and when I reach the half-hour point, I'm like, how are they going to drag this out for another entire hour?
And they don't.
And it's the same kind of story. I mean, it's interesting stories. You've got a lot of celebrities like George Clooney, Angelica Houston, Jeff Goldblum. Wes Anderson loves the Carlisle. You'll be shocked to learn. Elaine Stritch is always entertaining.
Elaine Stritch, she's always great.
She's great, yeah. And you have, you know, concierges and bellmen who've been there for 30 years, and your discretion is paramount, and so they don't really want to tell any stories. They don't want to dish. It's about how it's a really special and really expensive and really fancy hotel that a lot of celebrities like. This director also made a movie about Bergdorf's and a movie about Tiffany's, so this is in his wheelhouse.
A series, yeah. Yes. Peter?
Yeah, and they're all equally infomercial. this movie made me feel very poor. I mean, really, you know, and I know Clooney's a good guy, but there's something sort of smugly self-satisfying about all these rich movie stars talking about their rooms. And, you know, I mean, Clooney's room is like $15,000 a night.
Right. He and them all live there for 3 weeks at one point, and they turn one of the rooms into a closet for her clothing. That's kind of interesting, but... Yeah,
you know, and frankly, you know, as you say, I mean, there isn't enough dirt in it. There's no dirt in this movie. If you're going to see a movie about the Carlisle, how about some of the you know, behind-the-scenes stories? But everyone that they interview has worked there for, you know, 200 years. He says, well, you know, I can't, I'm not at liberty to say anything about our clients. That's not what we do. He says, all right, so then why make the movie?
Matthew Mealy made it. It's always at the Carlisle, rated PG-13, at Lemley's Monica Film Center and Regal West Park in Irvine. The action comedy Show Dog stars Will Arnett, Chris Ludacris Bridges, Natasha Lyonne, and Gabriel Iglesias, Stanley Tucci in the cast. Max Botkin and Mark Hyman wrote it, and Raja Gosnell is the director. What'd you think, Christy?
Yeah, I'm not sure this is either an action movie or a comedy. It's got talking dogs. I don't know. You know what? I'm down for a good talking dog movie. You know, and if it's funny and it's stupid looking, I can laugh along with it. This feels like it was made in the 80s. Like, the effects are so cheesy and the talking dog effects are so jumpy and it just looks terrible and the jokes aren't funny. And even the jokes that are aimed at the humans, the adults rather, aren't funny. Will Arnett is doing a New York accent that goes in and out. It's basically, it's Miss Congeniality in the dog pageant world, right? So
yeah,
Ludacris voices this Rottweiler who teams up with Will Arnett, who's an FBI agent, and they have to go undercover into the elite dog show circuit to uncover a panda smuggling ring.
Yeah, if you want to see a good talking dogs movie, see Isle of Dogs, please. All right, which some of you guys trashed on this show. Terrific movie. I mean, any movie with Stanley Tucci can't be all bad. And
yeah,
I found it
yeah.
a sort of unobjectionable film. If I was five, I'd probably like it more.
No, I brought my kid, who is eight, and he was like, this is terrible. I want to go home.
Well, he's a film critic.
He's got high standards. His mother made that possible. Show Dogs is the film. How are the talking effects? Are they... convincing?
No.
No.
I want realism in my talking dog movie.
So apparently,
see, Isle of Dogs.
Apparently, the director, though, is experienced because he did Beverly Hills Chihuahua.
He did.
So.
He did a couple of Smurfs and a couple of Scooby-Doos, and he did Beverly Hills Chihuahua. So this is something he knows.
Typecast.
Big Mama's House. Yes. So I detect a theme here.
It's a broad style of comedy, yes.
Raja Gosnell is the director. Max Botkin and Mark Hyman are the screenwriters of Show Dogs, starring Will Arnett, Chris Bridges, Natasha Lyonne, and Gabriel Iglesias. The movie is rated PG and Show Dogs in wide release. The Polish drama Dark Crime stars Jim Carrey, Charlotte Gainsbourg, and Alexandros Vranas is the director. Jeremy Brock is the screenwriter. And this is based on an article called True Crimes, a Postmodern Murder Mystery. Peter?
Yeah, no doubt more interesting than the movie. Jim Carrey is a Polish, get this, a Polish police officer with a large beard. Who's reopening a cold case murder, which he believes involves a famous novelist and a sex club in Krakow and so forth. And it's very lugubrious. It's very, you know, dark in ways that I found uninteresting. This may be unfair, but I don't think that Jim Carrey should be doing all these really serious roles. He's such a marvelous, marvelous comedian. A comic actor, and when he does these serioso roles, it seems like he's blanking out the best part of him. I know that every comic actor wants to play Hamlet, but, you know, I didn't even think Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was all that great. But this movie, I think, is just really lugubrious in the extreme.
Yeah, there are movies that Jim Carrey has done. Last year, he was in The Bad Batch. Right, which will tap into the inherent weirdness in the dramatic side of his persona. This doesn't even do that. There's a numbing sameness to the bleakness here. Everything is gray. It is all meant for gratuitous shock value. The first few images we see are of naked women tied up and being degraded or abused somehow in the sex club. I don't know whether it's meant to titillate or shock or both.
Yeah, it's more exploitative than revelatory, I think.
Well, speaking of comic actors doing dramatic roles, we saw this a lot with Robin Williams as his career progressed. And you know, what do you think this is about? That you know, we don't take comedic actors as seriously. We don't, you know, they don't get the Oscar nominations their talent.
Some of the greatest performances ever in American movies have been comic performances. Steve Martin in All of Me and so forth. You know, I mean, Eddie Murphy in The Nutty Professor. But I do think that comic actors don't get, you know, taken seriously as, quote, artists until they do serious stuff. And some of them are quite good at doing serious stuff, much more so than serious actors trying to be comic. But there are exceptions. Robin Williams was terrific in a couple of dramatic roles or semi-dramatic roles like Garp and Dead Poets Society and a film that no one saw for television of the adaptation of Saul Bellow's Seize the Day. He was remarkable in that.
He was great in 1 hour photo.
Yeah,
I mean, creepy and serious.
Yeah, but I think that there is in every comic actor the desire to be serious, not just to win awards, but to show that you're the complete deal.
Right.
And I understand that. I just think that at a certain point, maybe you should recognize that one thing works better than the other, and that you're giving joy to millions of people doing one thing. And you know, clonking people over the head with lugubriousness with the other.
Yeah, even Adam Sandler, you know, a frequent target of ours, you know, because his comedies are terrible and they're phoned in. When he does do something serious, like Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah, or Meyerowitz.
Or like Meyerowitz or Spanglish.
He's very good in that.
Right, there is depth there. And I can see why they want to, you know, show they can do it all.
We're talking about the film Dark Crimes, which stars Jim Carrey as a Polish investigator. Alexandros Varnas. us is the director, Jeremy Brock, the screenwriter, based on David Grand's article from 10 years ago, True Crimes, a Postmodern Murder Mystery. Film's rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Coming up in just a minute, Justin Chang, our film critic for the LA Times, joins us from Cannes at the Film Festival. Tell us what he particularly liked and also talk about some of the news made at Cannes over the past week plus. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by LA Times and Film Week critic Justin Chang, who's in Cannes for the 2018 festival, which is winding down this weekend. Justin, thanks so much for joining us late at night there.
My pleasure, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk just a couple overall themes before we get into specific films. You know, what's the sense of whether this year's festival met expectations or didn't?
Well, there was a lot of naysaying about the film festival beforehand because of the lack of big stars this year, the kind of lack of high-profile, potentially Oscar-contending titles, this kind of spat that the festival had with Netflix because they banned Netflix films from the competition and then Netflix pulled out altogether. So it was kind of looking like a downer year for the festival, but I'm always eternally optimistic, especially when it comes to Cannes. And there were a lot of new filmmakers, new names, a lot of international, from countries you don't necessarily know their cinemas very well. And I'm always optimistic. And I say, give these filmmakers a chance. And I've actually been pleasantly surprised by the lineup. It's actually an incredibly strong year for Asian filmmakers, which is not always the case in Cannes, but there are about five or six of them in competition, and I think every one of them has been quite good.
Well, let's talk about one of them from South Korean director Lee Chang-dong, Burning. What'd you think of that?
I think it's a masterpiece, and maybe his third in a row, possibly. He's one of my favorite filmmakers. He did things like Poetry and Secret Sunshine. This is a drama adapted from a Haruki Murakami short story, which he has elaborated quite substantially. Typical just example of what he does so well, really emotional sublety. You don't always know where it's going. It's moment to moment, very unpredictable. It's a story about a young man who's troubled and, going, he's kind of moving between Seoul and his rural hometown and becoming involved with two other characters. And it's spellbinding, really, really riveting, quiet, slow burn. Truly, the title's Burning. It's a very slow burning film, and one that I hope American audiences will get the chance to see.
We're talking about Burning, South Korean film from Lee Chang-dong. Another Asian movie that I know you were high on is the Japanese film Shoplifters. This is about a family of crooks?
Yes, it's about a family that gets a kind of a makeshift family of people from all different kind of other families and walks of life, and some kids who get kind of picked up off the street, and so they're struggling to survive. Koreeda is, he's a master. I mean, so much so that I think we run the risk of taking his films for granted. He's in Cannes very often. He's insanely prolific. I think this is his second film in less than a year or so. And yet this one, even by his standards, is really something quite special. He really, he has just this gift for he takes this really wrenching emotional material, but he kind of fillets it so delicately that you aren't necessarily left in this puddle of tears, but I love this movie, and it has this quiet ache that just built and built. So really, really special. I'm again, it's one that I imagine will make its way to theaters here at some point in the next year.
The film is Shoplifters from Koreeda Hirokazu. Also, the much anticipated Spike Lee film BlacKkKlansman. This is based on the story of Ron Stallworth, who was a black police officer in Colorado who infiltrated the local Ku Klux Klan. John David Washington, Adam Driver, Topher Grace star in the film. Spike Lee was one of the screenwriters. What'd you think, Justin?
I think it's pretty really good. I think Spike Lee's really been, he's had this resurgence. I think, Chirac was really terrific, and this one continues that upward swing. This is one of the few American films in the competition this year, so a lot of hopes were riding on this one. It's a very angry, urgent, politically urgent movie that speaks very much to our present era of resurgent, white supremacist violence and activity. Spike Lee is not known for his subtlety, perhaps, but this is a time when subtlety is not really called for, and he really does go for it. He gave this very, very entertaining press conference where he was referring to the president using expletives and such, which got a lot of attention.
That's a shock, isn't it?
No, it's not a shocker. And John David Washington, who is Denzel Washington's son, gives a really nice performance. And Adam Driver, no surprise, who plays the Jewish cop who is kind of playing this, the undercover. So you have this a black cop and a Jewish cop infiltrating the Klan, pretending to be the same person. It's a comedy, too. I mean, he really gives it this, in a way that I think Spike Lee has done in the past, this mixture of political urgency and, topical satire.
Stallworth, by the way, has also put out a book. I just got a copy of it, and I'm looking forward to reading his story about it. A Black Klansman is Spike Lee's new film. It's at the Cannes Film Festival, the festival wrapping up this weekend. And allowed back in, Lars von Trier, the writer-director, after his, I don't remember how many years ago, but said something about...
7 years ago.
Was it that he admired Hitler or something? And, of course, they made him persona non grata.
Yes, they did. And, we all expected that he would be welcome back at some point. They had to make a show of punishing him. Anti-Semitism, and in his case, I think very just a really stupid joke that... they would make amends at some point. But the movie itself, which is a serial killer thriller starring Matt Dillon as, this sort of Ed Gein type, who is a stand-in for von Trier himself, and which becomes this, this equation of, the art, the unmisunderstood artist and this misunderstood serial killer. It's the most unrepentant statement a filmmaker could possibly make. He is just trolling us in this movie, I've admired von Trier's films with reservations in the past. I pretty much hated every minute of this one, and yet which also infuriated me, because that is exactly the reaction he wants. He wants you to hate him, and he wants you to to bring out your anger, so you almost don't want to give him the satisfaction of that. But the movie is basically you're watching Matt Dillon brutalize perfectly lovely actresses like Uma Thurman and Riley Keough for 2.5 hours. Yeah. So it is an anti-entertainment, and I do not recommend that anyone see this one.
The House That Jack Built is the Lars von Trier film. Also, want to mention the Polish movie from Paweł Pawlikowski that you'd like so much, Cold War. And that's a 50s-era romance?
Yes, starts in the late 50s, kind of as the rise of communism in post-war Poland. This is very much a companion piece to his Oscar-winning film, Ida. Very austere, black and white, reminiscent of past movies in its aesthetic, and it's so pared down. This movie is under 90 minutes. It might even be like, I think, 84 minutes, and it just leaps forward years of time as this couple who have come together, and yet their romance, you get the sense, is doomed from the start. And it's just this heartbreaking romance that's done so economically that in a way makes its emotional ache even more pronounced. Really, really well acted too. So just beautiful filmmaking, extremely subtle, precise filmmaking. So and this is, Pawlikowski has not really been, he won the Oscar, and his star has really much been on the rise. I think this was his first film in the competition at Cannes. And it's one of a few, several contenders that are being talked about for the Palme d'Or, which is the top prize of the festival.
All right, the Polish film Cold War. And we've got about 30 seconds, but I assume you're looking forward to Terry Gilliam's new movie, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
Yeah, I don't know how high hopes I have for it, but, he's been working on this project for years and years, so it will be a relief, certainly for him more than anyone else, to have it out there. And there was also, there was a lawsuit with the producer involved, and they were trying to keep the film from playing, but happily for Gilliam and for the film, it will be shown on the night of Cannes.
Hey, thank you so much, Justin Chang. We appreciate it joining us late night at the Cannes Film Festival. Thanks so much, and enjoy the last couple of days. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Our Film Week and Los Angeles Times film critic Justin Chang. For all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk with you next week.